Welcome, everyone, to the Arthroscopy Association's Arthroscopy Journal podcast. I'm Dr. Andrea Spiker from the University of Wisconsin, and today I am joined by Associate Professor Peter D'Alessandro, who is an orthopedic surgeon based at the University of Western Australia in Perth. He is a team surgeon for the professional football and rugby teams at the Fremantle Dockers, Western Force, and Perth Glory. He is deputy chairman of the ISACOS Hip, Groin, and Thigh Committee and is the program director for the Perth Sports Surgery Fellowship. Dr. D'Alessandro was the senior author of the article entitled Endoscopic Tendon Release for Iliopsoas Impingement After Total Hip Arthroplasty, Excellent Clinical Outcomes and Low Failure Rates at Short-Term Follow-Up, which was published in the March 2024 edition of the Arthroscopy Journal. Dr. D'Alessandro's co-authors were Michael Finsterwald, Fabio Mancino, Georgina Waters, Jay Ebert, Shabazz Malik, Christopher Jones, and Piers Yates. Welcome, Dr. D'Alessandro, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me, Andrea.
So, Pete, it's truly a pleasure to have you joining us from Australia. To begin our discussion today, would you mind just telling us more about yourself and your practice?
Sure. You've given me a very kind introduction. And as you mentioned, I'm based in Perth, Western Australia, which is about as far away from Wisconsin as you can get. I have an academic practice at the University of Western Australia and a public-private practice here in Perth, mostly focused on sports surgery and the management of athletes in particular. As you mentioned, run the Perth Sports Surgery Fellowship, which we've been running for 7 years and is something we're really proud of as we, we run really high volume sports service in particular due to the amount of pivoting sports played in Australia due in large part to our fabulous weather, which we were talking about a moment ago. But our arthroscopy practice certainly translates into hip arthroscopy and perhaps a slightly unusual cohort for my practice being the management of patients with psoas impingement after total hip arthroplasty. But as I tell this cohort, these are my cohort of older athletes, and we want to get them back doing all the things they love as well.
Excellent. Now, today we'll be discussing your article on endoscopic tendon release for iliopsoas impingement after total hip arthroplasty. And this was published in the Arthroscopy Journal in March. Can you give us the background on why you decided to look at this research question of outcomes after endoscopic release in the setting of a total hip replacement?
Yeah, so Andrea, you know, hip pain, groin pain after total hip arthroplasty is actually more common than we think. I mean, realistically, you know, total hip arthroplasty is probably the best orthopedic operation we know. Really predictable results, and the vast majority of patients do really well. And yet there's definitely a sub-cohort of patients who present with groin pain that is often unspecified, undiagnosed. And yet what we have found, a significant proportion of these, probably more than what is represented in the literature, are actually related to iliopsoas impingement. And in our center, particularly with my arthroplasty colleagues, Chris Jones and Piers Yates, both of whom also did fellowships in the USA and in HSS and Texas in, respectively, we decided to be a little more proactive at investigating patients with hip pain following arthroplasty and incorporating them into our sports practice for examination assessment, both clinically and radiologically with dynamic OPS scanning, as we mentioned in the paper, with a really low threshold for diagnostic injection as well. And we found that the incidence of psoas impingement was more than what had previously been described. And as we discuss in the paper, have come up with an investigation algorithm and a treatment pathway that has been remarkably successful with an arthroscopic or endoscopic procedure, because it's performed at the LT, that is really quite straightforward, highly predictable. And we all love winners in orthopedics. This cohort of patients are winners. They come to your clinic miserable and they leave day of surgery and every follow-up afterwards, delighted. So as a surgeon, we love treating these patients.
Well, it sounds like you've got an excellent team. And so do I understand correctly that you yourself don't perform the arthroplasty and your partners do, or is arthroplasty also a part of your practice?
Yeah, correct. I'm not an arthroplasty surgeon. I'm a sports surgeon, sort of, I guess, a North American style sports surgeon. And in terms of my practice, as you mentioned, you know, I'm a significant proportion of my patients is sports knee surgery, multi-ligament surgery, shoulder instability with the athletes that you mentioned previously. With we look after a number of professional sports teams, and certainly knee and shoulder is the predominance. And I do a lot of hip arthroscopy, certainly a high volume hip arthroscopist here in Western Australia. And that makes me, given really as I'm one of only three arthroscopists in our state, I guess a tertiary referral source for hip arthroscopy. And my arthroplasty colleagues therefore refer into me, and the two senior colleagues who are part of this paper are also part of our Orthopaedic Research Foundation of Western Australia, and certainly prolific authors in their own right. And so our collaboration has been very valuable at, I guess, informing and educating our arthroplasty colleagues that iliopsoas impingement exists. It's often perhaps I think underdiagnosed, perhaps because our arthroplasty colleagues don't really, you know, forgive me for saying it, want to diagnose it, because it's, you know, it's not part of their, I guess, plan A of performing arthroplasty. Traditional open iliopsoas release is not a hugely rewarding procedure, and therefore these patients we found were either not being diagnosed or sort of being shuffled around with relatively nebulous diagnoses. But through this paper, which we presented at a state level for a couple of years before publication, we've really improved the education in our state and have found the tertiary referral practice as part of this to have become a really valuable pathway for management in our state.
Well, Pete, you highlight a lot of excellent points on the collaboration between two specialties. I myself am also on the sports side and don't do arthroplasty as part of my practice. And I completely agree with you that it's sometimes a siloed situation where we're not meeting in the middle. And this collaboration of yours is a perfect example of how that can help patients and help us better understand the problem here.
Mm. And I think that, sorry, Andrea, I was going to say, I think that sort of translates into what we describe in the paper about cup positioning as well, because our results on that came as a surprise and certainly weren't part of our hypothesis, but I think were a key part of, the outcomes, which I think provide some reassurance to our arthroplasty colleagues as well.
And that leads to my next question. Is how do you or what are the reasons that a patient might experience iliopsoas impingement? These patients that are being referred to you, what are some of the reasons that that you're seeing as related to their symptoms of iliopsoas impingement after hip arthroplasty?
Yeah, Andrea, I think the traditional reason that is described is certainly acetabular, component position. Certainly acetabular retroversion, cup overhang are the two most common causes, prominent rim of the cup at the iliopsoas notch, patients with anterior wall hyperplasia, but also length offset, more iatrogenic issues such as retained cement, prominent femoral collars, all of these take potential issues, but the vast majority are likely due to cup position. What's interesting from our paper is that there's almost certainly a dynamic component here. And what I mean by that is that the spinopelvic relationship is crucial. And I think more and more research into cup position with now dynamic planning that goes on with arthroplasty morphing into robotics, we realize that the traditional concept of the safe zone is perhaps a little basic, and dynamism in patient positioning is crucial. And so what we actually find is that patients actually can present late. They may be fine. They may have latent periods of, you know, months and even years. I have one patient who presented with iliopsoas pain 11 years after his primary arthroplasty, and that's almost certainly due to the fact that changes in the spinopelvic relationship, mostly due to degenerative lumbar spine or perhaps an arthroplasty on the other side, or even, you know, knee arthroplasty or arthritis that changes biomechanics, leading to altered relationships and gait abnormalities that then lead to issues with iliopsoas impingement that becomes symptomatic. And so it's not a static phenomenon. It is dynamic, which is why patients can present at various times. And I think that's a crucial learning point. It's often ruled out because of late presentation, but that's certainly not the case. But then the other part, as I mentioned, is that even in cases where there does appear to be static malposition related to overhang or retroversion, this operation works in a predictable fashion. And certainly it's a vastly less morbid operation than a revision with a cup revision, which had been the traditional approach.
Very interesting insight into the dynamic component here. Do you find that there's a difference in the symptoms that patients describe when they have early onset of symptoms versus late?
I must admit, I don't. But in terms of symptoms, the symptomatology of psoas impingement is almost pathognomonic. You know, our patients are diagnosed on the history. I think 90% of the time, they all describe the same thing. Sure, there's groin pain, but they all describe a perception of weakness. They show you a maneuver where getting in and out of bed using that limb or in and out of their cars, and we have big SUVs here in Western Australia as well, which are often high. They have to basically lift their leg up to create passive flexion because active flexion causes pain. And those combined with if they stub their toe or accidentally kick a table, they get sharp shooting pain. And certainly those symptoms, and when you get them on the examination couch and you put the examination couch up nice and high and you see them having to lift their hip up onto the couch, that patient has impingement. And that really can present at any time point. And as I said, the vast majority of the diagnosis is really done on history. But as we describe in the paper, certainly our psoas provocation on an examination, and then finally our use of diagnostic injection has been very valuable, because the diagnostic injection is certainly a positive predictive, has a high positive predictive value for success after the endoscopic release.
Wonderful. Now, Pete, can you walk us through your technique and then discuss some of the tips, tricks, and pearls that you can offer based on your own experiences with your technique?
Yeah, certainly, Andrea. And I think the overall message here is endoscopic release at the lesser trochanter is a straightforward procedure. The majority of my fellows come from the UK, although we were discussing on email earlier today, we'd love to have some fellows from the US come and visit us in Western Australia, and we promise them a great time. And the majority of my fellows have a soft tissue knee interest and don't have a huge hip arthroscopy interest, and yet we can teach all our fellows endoscopic psoas release really within three or four cases. I place them on my standard hip arthroscopy traction table without a central bolster. No traction is required. I mark out my standard portals, but I don't actually use my standard anterolateral and mid-anterior portals. They're more distal and they are slightly more anterior. It's generally a two-portal technique, centered over the lesser trochanter. I have the hip placed in slight flexion and external rotation, though being careful on entry, not to externally rotate too much for crossing the danger zone of the neurovascular bundle. Standard cannulation, as one would do for any hip arthroscopy, under image intensifier control. And I basically place my first needle onto the anterior cortex of the femur around the proximal part of the lesser trochanter, feel for bone, 30-degree scope to start here rather than a 70, which I would normally start in a standard hip arthroscopy, and then very straightforward triangulation with my distal portal. There's always a nice little bursa sitting over the LT, which once you're down on bone, it's easily identifiable and it's safe because we've sort of crept our way along the anterior cortex. I go straight to using my RF device, my Werewolf, to basically peel off that bursa over the anterior aspect of the lesser trochanter. And we just start walking our way medially, and progressively externally rotating. And I think it's really important to understand the anatomy of the iliopsoas. It is mostly a posteriorly based structure on the LT. And I think it's really important to recognize that although you might start relatively anterior for safety and for reproducibility of access, the key is as you're walking your way medially, one needs to be able to progressively externally rotate and flex the hip to allow more posterior access. And we can eventually see those glistening white fibers of the iliopsoas, which I just start to peel off with my RF device. And as long as my portals are anterior enough, we can start to peel them off the lesser trochanter. And we basically just continue to perform that until my limb is in about 70 degrees of flexion and 30 to 40 degrees of external rotation, continuously assessing macroscopically under II. And certainly you can assess quite easily once you've achieved a complete release of the iliopsoas, because you can see muscle of the psoas and the iliacus there. Generally swap portals to ensure that I've achieved a complete resection both proximally and distally. Occasionally I'll striate the iliacus as well if there is tendon in the vicinity. But you know, it really is, as I said, it really is, as we say to our fellows, this is not rocket surgery, but it is certainly a winning procedure. It is safe and reproducible, and it's generally done in 15 to 20 minutes. We post-operatively have our patients weight-bearing as tolerated as a day procedure, and the majority of our patients, they wake up and they start moving their hip up and down, and they feel wow. I often get asked about weakness, and this is obviously something we discuss in the paper, but the amazing part is, although we are doing a lengthening and it is an intramuscular tendon, so we're not doing a tenotomy per se, it's a tendon lengthening because it is intramuscular at this point, the early patient results really are quite profound.
That was an excellent description. So can I ask you, do you ever use the transcapsular release approach? And if not, why not? Or what your preference for the lesser trochanteric release is?
Yeah, so I did fellowships in London in the UK and then in Vancouver at the University of British Columbia, and have some great friends there. And we certainly did some transcapsular releases there. I think the two key differences for me is at the transcapsular release is a little less predictable for me. Capsule after arthroplasty is obviously has an element of scar tissue format, and it's a little hard in some cases, I find, to really definitively differentiate between capsule and iliopsoas tendon. And certainly given the closer proximity of the neurovascular bundle anteriorly there, I certainly find that to be a more, for want of a better word, nervous procedure. And I felt that in my early releases, I was perhaps under-releasing at the capsule compared to what I can achieve at the LT, which I can be very, very confident that I have achieved a complete release. So certainly, I think that is a first part. The second part of transcapsular that I think concerns me is a little is the tendon muscle relationship and what has been published in a couple of other papers regarding the possibility of instability of the replacement following release at the transcapsular level. And then the final part, which I guess goes the other way, is certainly if there are cases where we are concerned about potentially loose cement or metallosis or trunnionosis as part of our diagnostic workup for a painful hip, those we will certainly perform an arthroscopy at the joint, and we can certainly reproduce, you know, and that's an important part of the workup in that cohort. But I must admit, since my conversion to an LT release, and again, with the results we've shown in this paper, we've not looked back.
Excellent. Well, let's briefly touch on your results. So in your paper, you found that that about 37% of the patients in your clinic presented with immediate pain after their total hip replacement. Yes. Nearly 90% received a preoperative diagnostic injection with very strong positive response, which we've discussed. Another finding in your cohort was that about 67% of patients had a posterior approach. Have you noticed that there's a correlation between the approach for the hip replacement and whether they have iliopsoas symptoms afterwards?
Yeah, so some really, really good points there. I think to start with the first, you know, I think that's insightful that only 37% presented with immediate pain after total hip. And again, I think that's a misnomer about iliopsoas impingement. The majority present late. So do not rule out iliopsoas impingement just because pain presents late. Two-thirds of patients present late. 90% having a diagnostic injection. Certainly our practice is that everyone gets a diagnostic injection. And the only patients that don't are the patients who personally declined it. And then the third was the correlation between approach. We felt that we've not been able to have sufficient numbers to have a true correlation between approach and impingement. And we felt that the numbers, which I think was 67% posterior, just under 20% direct anterior, and the remainder anterolateral, were really just reflective of the approach in our state. Certainly, again, like in any joint replacement, access and exposure, certainly we are correlated with more adequate cut position, but we weren't able to definitively correlate a certain approach with cut malposition and or impingement, though it would certainly, you know, make sense that retroversion is associated with approach and therefore with impingement.
And we mentioned this earlier, but you found no correlation of cup overhang with the success of your endoscopic iliopsoas release. So even those patients with perhaps a less than ideally placed acetabular component did well after your procedure. So how do you interpret these findings?
Yeah. And again, Andrea, I think this is one of the key take-home messages to be passed on to our arthroplasty colleagues. And is that, you know, and as I said, this wasn't our hypothesis, but we certainly found that, again, perhaps due to that dynamic component, perhaps due to the fact that this lengthening does provide sufficient response that once the, I guess, scar slash regeneration happens. It occurs in perhaps a lengthened position and is no longer irritative in spite of that overhang or retroversion. That is why patients are able to maintain their positive results. But certainly, what had been suggested previously was that cases with iliopsoas impingement and overhang or retroversion really should just go straight for cup revision. But our results do not indicate that. And again, given the significantly less morbidity of this procedure, we very much recommend this to be a first-line procedure, irrespective of cup position.
Very powerful results and practice-changing potentially as well. Now, one last question related to that is that you did find that patients had about 20% decreased hip flexion strength at about 6 months post-release of their iliopsoas tendon. Is this a significant clinical situation? Do they complain about this amount of weakness, or is that less noticeable to the patients?
Yeah, again, great question. And I think, to be honest, this is probably one of the limitations of our study, in that we didn't measure hip flexion strength preoperatively. And what we actually found was that, although we don't have a preoperative measurement, but anecdotally, the patients actually had a vast improvement in their hip flexion strength. So although it was 20% down compared to their contralateral side, the patient's perception was that this was much improved compared to their preoperative state. Now, whether that was due to mostly pain inhibition related weakness, which is most likely, or the impingement basically defunctioning the psoas, it's difficult to tell. But I guess I'd actually flip that finding to say that only a 20% decreased hip flexion strength in spite of a lengthened iliopsoas tendon was actually a really positive finding. And it was extremely rare for our patients to have to complain about weakness, because their perception was certainly that they were stronger post-release because they no longer had the pain inhibition associated with their impingement.
Well, Pete, thank you so much for your time and expertise. This has been incredibly educational and a very interesting discussion. Before we end today, any final thoughts that you have for the listeners?
No, as I said, this has been it's been great to chat to you, and appreciate the opportunity. Western Australia is we laugh that Perth is perhaps the most isolated city in the world, but we certainly punch above our weight here in orthopedics, and in particular sports surgery. So it's a pleasure to be chatting to you, and certainly a privilege to have a publication in the Arthroscopy Journal this month. And it's great to be part of the AANA and ISACOS, which you mentioned earlier, which allows me to collaborate with my North American friends and colleagues.
Well, wonderful to have you. Thank you again. Dr. D'Alessandro's article titled Endoscopic Tendon Release for Iliopsoas Impingement After Total Hip Arthroplasty, Excellent Clinical Outcomes and Low Failure Rates at Short-Term Follow-Up, can be found online at www.arthroscopyjournal.org. This concludes our episode of the Arthroscopy Journal podcast. Thank you for joining us. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of the Arthroscopy Association or the Arthroscopy Journal.